Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Board Game Barbecue Podcast. This is Jules here, your host for today. It's episode 279, and I'm joined by a fellow Sydney-sider, Lauren. How are you doing, Lauren?
Yeah, really good. Thanks, Jules.
I'm very excited for this episode today because we also have a special guest with us all the way from the other side of the world, whose work you might, the most familiar work you might be aware of would be his design in Feudum. It is Mark Swanson. How are you doing, Mark?
Pretty good, Jules. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic. I've been very much looking forward to this chat. I reached out a little while ago and said, would you like to come on the podcast? I enjoy your game Feudum, and I've been following the progress of some exciting games that you're working on, which I'm sure we'll get to in a second. But yeah, we're very happy to have you here.
And hi, Lauren. I forgot to say hi to you too.
Doing great. Also super, super stoked. Really excited for this chat.
Very good. Well, let's launch into it, shall we? Mark, do you want to just give everyone a bit of a preamble about who you are and how you got into game design?
Yeah, okay. Well, I have a degree in strategic communications, which is just a fancy way of saying advertising and public relations. And in my younger days, I worked as an advertising copywriter and a
creator.
And I came up with words and headlines for everything from dog food to comic book conventions, CT scanners, you name it. I grew up on fantasy adventure novels, J.R.R. Tolkien, David Eddings, Piers Anthony. So I've always loved sci-fi, fantasy adventure, medieval worlds, you know, where anything could happen. And I've always loved board games, but originally just kind of the American variety of games, you would say. But it wasn't until about the late 90s that I discovered Euro style games. I guess they used to be called German board games.
Of course,
and then
yes.
And then it morphed into the moniker Euro style. And I immediately fell in love with titles like Puerto Rico, Tigris and Euphrates. Remember that
one? Oh, yes. Yes.
Power Grid, El Grande, Taj Mahal, Ra. There's so many.
That's a heavy hitting list.
And I got hooked. And, you know, games are like novels in a way. You know, the more you play them, the more you're drawn to a specific game author. And particular kinds of mechanics. So, you know, like if you like a horror genre, you might read Stephen King. Or if you like political thrillers, you'd read Tom Clancy. So for me, I found myself gravitating to Reiner Knizia and Martin Wallace and Uwe Rosenberg and then particular game mechanics. Like I love area control or action programming, worker placement. And so it all kind of clicked for me. And about 2010, I started thinking about the kind of game I would like to invent. Well, actually, first I looked to see if it existed and I couldn't find it. And then I invented it, and that was Feudum.
In that little preamble, you mentioned a whole list of games, and I can start to see all these different things coalescing in the design of Feudum, which I have played before. But just touching on your, you know, transition of, you know, having a love for board games, but really discovering the Euro genre, was there any game in particular that really what you found was like a turning point in your love of those style of games?
Well, like a lot of folks, you know, Settlers of Catan was early. That was Reiner Knizia's classic, often considered the gateway game to other Euro-style games. But the first game I ever played that was Euro in nature was a game called Cartagena. It was about escaping from an island, underground island fortress. And then inside that game, there was a little pamphlet, a little flyer that listed other games from other publishing companies. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I'll get one of these. And eventually I stumbled onto Settlers and we played that to death, and Cities and Knights and, you know, all the expansions. And then I kept on pushing it a little further until I found Puerto Rico, Andrew Safar's game. And I thought, wow, here's a game that uses variable player powers in a cool way. And it's so popular. So I think it was on Board Game Geek's number one list for 5 years or something.
Yeah, right.
Mm. Yeah, crazy, crazy run. And they had tournaments. And so I really got into that game. And then a lot of other games followed. There's a game called Maharaja that actually helped inspire Feudum a little bit. And a game, let's see, I'm trying to think of some other ones. There's a game called Shogun. Dirk Kahn. And if you remember that game, that one unfolds very, very long, very similar to how the Feudum board unfolds.
Yeah, fantastic. So you've mentioned Feudum a couple of times. How about we dive into that? Because as I said at the start of the podcast, that's probably the game people are most familiar with. How did that come about? Because, you know, to give a little bit of context, and I'm sure you can give some more, Mark, Feudum I would describe as a game that is very much like a sandbox. There's so many things you can do, levers you can pull and push. There is a pun there. and there's area control. There's very Euro mechanics in there. There's just so much to explore, and it's kind of hard to pin down exactly what that game is. How did you conceptualize Feudum, and how would you better describe it than me, Mark?
Yeah, well, let's see. In a nutshell, you try to control guilds and spread influence and feud with other players in a medieval sandbox. At the time, I really liked video games. I played Grand Theft Auto, Red Dead Redemption. I loved open world video games, and I wanted a board game that was also open world.
Mm-hmm.
It took about 5 years to develop, and I'm talking about designing it, prototyping it, playtesting it. The playtesting alone took about a year because I collected a lot of data to help balance the game. And I wanted multiple paths to victory, and I wanted to make sure that people weren't able to break the game. You know, I had read an article about how Puerto Rico eventually was broken, and the designer had to rewrite a few rules because people figured out the certain numbers of buildings that if you got the same buildings, your percentage chance of winning increased dramatically. And so tournaments no longer became fun. And math, I guess, solved math is the death of mystery. So he had to go in and tweak it many years later. And I wanted to make sure that Feudum was balanced. And so I did tons of playtesting and tried to get people to break it. And I was kind of a no-name at the time. As a new designer, I had to work a little bit harder and build up my brand and make sure, you know, board game influencers were aware of what I was doing. And so I just slowly started to spread the word about how, you know, you have these unique characters, medieval characters that roam the countryside, tending farms and taxing towns and taking outposts in effort to rise in power. And I also knew that I needed a unique mechanic. You know, there's an ever-growing list of classic mechanics on Board Game Geek and that many people know about, from hand optimization to worker placement to area control, you name it. And I knew I needed something that I could call my own. And so I came up with this symbiotic relationship between guilds where you dutifully play your part in this progressive economic cycle where, say, for instance, the farmer ships goods to the merchant who then uses those goods to equip the alchemist who invents black powder, which equips the knight and so on and so forth in a circular fashion around the outer edge of the board of these guilds. And I had come up with this, and I wrote about it, and I posted it on Board Game Geek, and none other than Richard Hamm from Rotto Runs Through saw it and got excited about it, and that kind of put me on the map initially, because when he gets excited about a game, people listen. And
absolutely.
I was very grateful for that, and then that's one of the reasons Feudum took off.
Fantastic. So, as you said, this was your first design stepping into the world of board game design. And to me, I think a part of the success as well is that the box and the art on the board is so striking. So if I'm not mistaken, Justin Schultz was the artist and graphic design. Did he do both?
Yes, he did. He had a unique ability. Sometimes you have to have an illustrator, an artist,
yes,
a graphic designer, someone who does layout, a production artist, but he was just all of that in one person.
How did you meet Justin? How did that relationship come about?
Well, I knew I needed good art because, in my opinion, I'm quite keen on focusing on melding four things: story, mechanics, the production value of the game, and then the art. Because marrying form and function is important to me. So a game has to fire on all of those cylinders. You know, it's got to have a killer theme, unique mechanics, tactile presence, and then probably most important in making a first impression is the art. And so this is going to sound almost unbelievable, but it actually happened this way. I walked into an ice cream shop called Sparky's.
Right.
And I was getting an ice cream cone, and I looked on the wall, and there were several band posters. I believe one of them was for a band called Wilco. And the art featured this monster, this lumbering behemoth-like character, across the landscape, and it was whimsical and well drawn. And I thought, that's amazing. That who's the artist? I looked at the poster to see if there was an attribution. Nothing. So I went on the band's website, found the poster. Then I saw the attribution on the website, and I reached out to the artist in an email, a long rambling email saying, "You don't know me, but I have a dream about creating this game. Would you want to partner with me?" And to my surprise, he emailed me back saying, "I would love to do that."
Wow.
Wow. That's outstanding, because it definitely has a really unique aesthetic. And the board almost is reminiscent, as you were saying, the kind of fantasy worlds that you were inspired by and drawn to. When I see the map, it makes me think of Middle Earth. It makes me think of kind of panning across those fantasy worldscapes. Is that the kind of thing that you were trying to channel there?
Absolutely. It has kind of desaturated, muted color schemes, which I like. I like German Expressionism as an art form. And so that reminded me of that. I also love Adventure Time, the cartoon.
Yes.
Yes.
And there's this kind of whimsical feeling to Justin's artwork. You're lured in with what he likes to call the superficial charm, but then upon closer inspection, something daunting is happening.
Mm.
And so here you have this, you know, behemoth that looks cute and lovable, but he's about to squash these people fleeing in terror. So I like that juxtaposition.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I'd love to hear more about some of your upcoming designs as well, because I know you've got a few things in the pipeline, some that you've been working on for a few years, as well as an upcoming Kickstarter. So, I'd love to hear more about those that you've been working on at the moment.
Yes, well, the one that's coming up the soonest is called Fled. And the premise of that game is you are escaping from a vile Victorian prison. And that one launches March 5th. And I've always been a fan of prison escape movies, you know, Escape from Alcatraz and Shawshank Redemption. And I've always wanted to create a escape from prison game. And I did a little research and found out that Ireland has its own Alcatraz. It's called Spike Island. It's off the south coast of Ireland. Mm. And in the mid-1800s, it was a British fort turned prison. And during the time of the Irish potato famine, young lads were unjustly arrested for minor infractions, like stealing a potato, for instance. One lad was arrested for stealing a pint of milk. People were hungry. And back in those days, you could get thrown in prison for that sort of thing. And these young lads were thrown in prison. It was very harsh conditions. And so obviously in this game, you are rooting for the prisoners to escape. It's a tile game where you manage a hand of tiles, and each turn you add a tile to the prison, and then you discard other tiles that allow you to move your prisoner from room to room. while collecting illicit contraband, which then you trade for the tools that you need to escape. And you have to get past the outer wall, which is exactly 6 squares from the center yard tile. And if you're not in the right room when the governor summons you to roll call, a nearby warder could put you in shackles or even send you to solitary confinement. So that's the premise of that game. It was just a blast to make, and we had a lot of fun playtesting it. And so I'm really excited to unveil that to the world.
Yeah, I've been following the progress of this one. It looks really, really fun. And from how you've described it and, you know, the articles I've been following about it, it also sounds like a very tense game where, you know, that one tile placement can sort of make or break your escape. I'm very excited to see how this one comes into fruition. I'd love to get it. I'll be certainly backing this one because it looks absolutely fantastic.
There have been many playtests where multiple people escape. The game is balanced in a way where after you escape, everyone else gets one final turn. And oftentimes you have two or even three players escaping. But it's not enough to escape. You have to escape with enough victory points above your opponents, or they could actually outscore you even though you've escaped. So a little bit of a nifty strategic catch there.
Mm. And so who's the artist for that one that you had work on, Fled?
That is Clemens Franz.
Ah, yes. Okay.
He is known for, you know, famous titles like Agricola, Caverna, Laha, more recently, Boone Lake.
Yes.
His style, it's also whimsical in his own unique way.
So is this game, Feudum obviously is a very heavy game. Fled, is that the kind of people, more serious board gamers? Who are you pitching this game to?
So it is more of a medium weight game, mm-hmm. but it's not a lightweight tile game. Mm-hmm. So when I think of classic tile games, I think the game that pops into mind is Carcassonne.
Of course, yes.
And Carcassonne is, you know, really accessible, very light. But if you like Carcassonne, but you want something with a little bit more meat, more teeth, then Fled will be for you because it does have that kind of it scratches that tile placement itch. But then it adds these meeples that actually move around the laid tiles in the prison that basically unfolds before your very eyes. The tiles double as cards. So when you lay them, you're forming a map. But when you have them in your hand, they have icons on them which allow you to play certain icons to move your meeple or to put into your inventory in order to escape.
I've fallen in love a bit more recently with those tile laying games. Carcassonne is a classic you've mentioned. I've also enjoyed Land versus Sea, and I've been enjoying Cascadia a lot in recent years. It's a growing genre. I love seeing a board that grows with you as you progress through the game. So yeah, very excited for that. So not that, you know, this upcoming campaign is obviously going to consume a lot of your time, but you've still got more projects. The one I wanted to talk about is Fur. Now, this one I know you've been working again with Justin on the design and the artwork style for it. What can you tell us about this one? I've been following it since you posted first pictures on BGG. I love the setting, the lumberjack look. That's something I aspire to a little. But please tell me what you can about Fur.
Absolutely. Fur is a labor of love. Justin has worked so tirelessly on not only Feudum, but also all of its expansions. You know, originally, when I first created Feudum, I thought, okay, this is going to be my one and done game. It's my passion, my opus, if you will.
Yeah.
And then when it caught on, I thought, well, I have to release some expansions. Mm. And of course, I've always had certain number of expansions in mind while making the original game. And so I released those expansions, including a solo variant. And then I had to release a artisan edition vessels and castles.
They're stunning.
and all of that, right? And that was fun. And Justin was with me the whole way. And then there was a kind of a period of rest. Let's just call it rest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I approached Justin again. And I said, Justin, I have an idea for a new game. He said, oh, no, here we go. So he promised to work on it if, you know, I went easy on him because he has another job. And mm-hmm. and so this is one of those things that one of those sculptures that's being sculpted little by little.
Yes.
And so the object of Fur is to assemble a legendary band of loggers in the Pacific Northwest. It's actually based on the timber industry in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. And you have to shrewdly manage your timbermen, your lumberjacks, and your homesteads to earn the most victory points over 5 rounds. And so during the game, you task your workers. So you have your own little homestead and you start the game with 2 workers and you task them with all kinds of labor from felling fir trees to driving the logs down the river to milling timber to stoking steam donkeys. And one of the unique twists in this game is in order to be successful, you have to put your workers in harm's way.
Oh.
So there's a displacement mechanic that you actually deliberately want to have happen. So these bumps and bruises that happen are going to take their toll but send your worker into a nearby building where they become a foreman. So they're kind of on light duty, if you will. But when they're when they're a foreman, it gives you special privileges. And then it also frees you up to recruit day laborers. You can flip flapjacks, or you can even moonlight as an impresario, which is, you know, the guy that has the top hat that says step right up. And, and you know, back in the 1800s, a popular thing was to go to see the vaudeville acts, like in a town like Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And so these lumberjacks in the evening would go to these kind of rundown sections of town, which, by the way, had timber-lined streets, because you'd have to line streets with timber in order to drag big logs that were coming out of the forest over.
Gotcha. Yes.
Mm.
And these timber-lined streets, you would skid logs over them, and they were called skid roads.
Right.
And so when someone says, oh, this person wound up on Skid Row, or Skid Road is what it originally was called, that's the reference.
Wow, there you go.
Right.
You have to make decisions in this game. Are you gonna tend to your corn and your chickens? Are you gonna build bunks and barns or furnish your little river that goes through your homestead with bridges and what's called rocker boxes, which is how you pan for gold. So yeah, a lot to do. And it's so much fun to play test. I play tested this thing so many times, and I'm making fine tweaks on the game, and it's at a place now where I think I'm very, very close.
Oh, that's exciting.
Amazing. Yeah, I remember seeing an article about this one and have been, excited about it since then. Having a look at it and kind of having tracked its progression, it definitely is more reminiscent of those classic Euros that you said you'd love, the Uwe Rosenberg games. I definitely see parts of Agricola with your personal player boards. A little parts of the board almost remind me of Village as well.
Village is a wonderful game. That definitely was an inspiration. I would say Caverna. Mm. Which I think is like Agricola, more refined. Caverna, in a way, Fur is like a tribute to Caverna. It's one of my favorite games, Caverna. So I would say it's a top 5 game for me.
Very cool.
Yeah, outstanding.
So I'm going to probe a little bit harder here. And when you say you're very close, do you have a timeline in mind at this point in time that you can reveal?
No, not really. I hate to disappoint you.
No, that's fine.
I have to, out of respect for my artist, we're just going to keep on chipping away. And when I feel like I can reveal a month or a year, then I will.
That's fantastic. I'm sure when it's all said and done, there's going to be quite the reception to it. I'm very much looking forward to giving Fur a try.
Will this one be coming to crowdfunding as well?
Yes.
Great.
Fantastic. So I might dive into the next game that I know that you're working on, which is, let's just say, very far removed from everything we've been talking about at this point. And I don't know how much you can divulge, but you do have it listed on your website at Odd Bird Games. That's Forlords. This is a trading card game you're working on. How did you get started on that?
Oh boy, yeah, that is an amazing story too. I discovered an artist named Jake Morrison, and it was like striking gold in the Klondike. I think I first saw his art in a game called Brew, B-R-E-W.
Oh, yes. And,
yep.
Then I visited his Instagram page, and I was blown away. He was building a world filled with these weird and wonderful biomes, which offered refuge to, you know, mystical creatures, mutated monsters, what Jake calls bioengineered beings. And it was like this ready-made sandbox. And it gave me the thematic inspiration I needed to go into this deep creative hibernation and create something that I'd never created before, which was a collectible card game. He had the initial vision, and he came to me with, you know, some scribbles on paper. Here's what he'd like to do. And, you know, he heard I was a board game publisher. Would I be interested in publishing, you know, his game? And I said, well, you really have to have a game before I can publish it. You just have a couple of, you know, ideas here, but there's no rules, you know, and so I kind of humored him a little bit. And then he asked me a question. He said, well, what if you designed it? And initially I didn't have a good response, but I started thinking about it and coming up with a trading card game, specifically a dueling card battle, which is what this is, with, you know, the kind of staying power that Pokemon or Yu-Gi-Oh! Or Magic the Gathering has, is that's a challenge. It's no small task.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I've played my share of CCGs. You know, I've played Magic the Gathering, Game of Thrones, the card game by Eric Lang, and Star Realms, you know, trying to think of some recent stuff, Radlands.
Yes.
But doing something truly special was the challenge. But it started gnawing at me. So weeks kind of turned into months, and I started tinkering with some things and got some playtesters around me. And I kind of emerged from my lair, as it were, from what I considered to be fairly intricately woven mechanics that are elegant, which is what I strive for when you're creating something with substance and depth. It can be intricate, but it has to be elegant. And the playing experience, playtesters were calling the playing experience, you know, phenomenal, unlike anything they'd experienced before. And one of my harshest critics, who's a friend of mine and an attorney who's invested more money than he would care to admit on trading card games, after playing it said, this is incredible. How did you do this? Like, he didn't think I invented it.
Yeah, I said, right.
Wow. I said, maybe I'm smart. I don't know. Maybe I got lucky. Like, and he goes, Mark, I got to say, this is a really, really good game. And he said, I want to play it more. And so that's when my harshest critic started enjoying it and wanting to play it more, I thought, I think I might be onto something. And from that point, it sort of became something bigger than what I had created. And then I just got more and more excited. And the game, so to tell you a little bit about the game, it features, you know, some of the popular CCG mechanics like hand management, Mm-hmm. Player elimination, you know, you have to, you're battling against
an opponent. Of course.
When they get eliminated, you win. Deck construction. But it, as I said before, you know, coming up with unique mechanics is important to me. So it sets itself apart with kind of a handful of what I think are distinct mechanics. To name a few, there's you can explore a hostile and unpredictable wilderness in the middle. There's a stretch of land between you and your opponent that gets cards. And you have to, in order to get to your opponent, you have to kind of first do battle with the wilderness.
Interesting.
The game, you move cards on a grid and you tactically position your allies for battle, which is considered grid movement. Kind of like moving cards like chess.
Right.
So if you can imagine, you know, your boss or your king is in the middle on your side of the board, and then you imagine a 3x3 playing field. So essentially a card orthogonally to your king and also diagonally to your king, and that's your play area. Then you have a 3-space wilderness area in between you and your opponent, and then your opponent has his grid. And that's the setup. And then you unlock unique fortes, I'm calling them, during play, which are kind of like a boost to your allies, and that's variable player powers. And then I guess the next mechanic is where you gain surges in power by capturing one or more terrain tokens. And I thought, wow, that would be cool to come up with several tokens that actually get placed on the cards during gameplay, so that opponents could feel like there's a little bit of topography on the map. And so I came up with these cool terrain tokens that can change hands at several times during the game. And they're kind of like an advantage token, which gives you kind of this special action. Technically, an advantage token, like in the game Twilight Struggle, the China card gives you an advantage, and then after you use it, you pass it to the other player. But here, these tokens are yours until someone takes them from you.
Yeah,
so
right.
You potentially could have it the whole game. So that combination of terrain tokens and then allies that move on a grid just make for a very unique game.
Really fascinating. I grew up playing Magic the Gathering and have dabbled in other trading card games. It's from what you've described, it's nothing like I've ever heard of before. So I'm very, very curious to keep following the progress of Four Lords. Now, do you envision Four Lords being a trading card game in the sense like Magic the Gathering is, where you have booster packs that you'll open up and there are rarer cards than others, or more in the sense of like a, I don't know, Marvel Champions, where you can buy all the packs per se and you have all the cards that exist in that game?
So you're talking about like a living card game versus
a trading card. Yes.
That's a great question. So Fantasy Flight coined the term living card game, which is a fixed distribution of cards that doesn't require you to open a series of packs. And a lot of folks are like this because they don't want to, quote, pay to play.
Yes.
So for me, Four Lords, every starter deck of Four Lords is going to equip you with a very competitive deck. But Jake and I wanted people to still enjoy the mystery and excitement of booster packs that contain a rare or unique card. Because there's a certain joy of collecting.
Absolutely.
And interactively trading.
Yep.
You know, what Pokemon was invented, the whole idea was, oh man, I don't have the card I want, but you have it, and I have one that you want. Hey, let's trade. Exchange.
Absolutely. Yep.
Right. And that there's something really pure and fun about that. So I think Four Lords, people can still enjoy the mystery and excitement of a booster pack that contains a rare or unique card. But during deck construction, there's going to be limits on deck value and deck count, which forces a deck to remain competitive and balanced.
Right. Okay.
So it's not like you need that one legendary card in order to win.
Yeah, no, that sounds really cool. It's a space that, you know, the trading card space has a lot of movement. There's a lot of games that come and go, and you know, a lot of people try and make the magic killer, but this sounds something totally different, and I'm totally fascinated by it at this point, honestly. So do you have an idea, is this a 2025 or later thing? You know, where's it sitting at the moment?
It's right now, it's a 2025 thing.
Cool.
And Jake and I, you know, one of the things that Jake and I are really making sure we nail correctly is any booster pack is going to contain a certain number of guaranteed expansion cards.
Yeah,
so that players are legitimately expanding their starter deck. So it's not like, you know, oh, I bought this thing and
I got all the same stuff. Right?
So, and then, you know, all of the artwork that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a regular reward and then a super deluxe reward, where if you want, you can add these neoprene biome mats to your side.
Yeah. Very cool.
It's very easy to navigate a 3x3 grid in your mind, but some people like to have you know, something to put their cards on. So there's a lot of neat things that we're working on that just take more time. And then, of course, we want, once people get it and enjoy it, we want them to be able to quickly maybe get some boosters or get a different biome. The game has, right now it has 8 different biomes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Each biome gives these creatures refuge to live, thrive, evolve. So you have highlands and lowlands and wetlands and strange lands. And that's kind of like the system. And every biome has a unique icon. And so depending on how you want to play will dictate which biome you gravitate towards. During the game, you can also recruit allies from different biomes, and they basically fight under your flag, if you will, but you have to mark those with a faction marker. So you're a little bit limited in terms of how many foreign biome cards or allies you're playing.
Yeah, right.
It's definitely a very ambitious design. There's a lot of things going on. I mean, just designing a balanced TCG with asymmetry already is a challenge enough, but there seems to be a lot of other moving pieces integrated into the game, which is really exciting and sounds really novel. What are kind of the biggest, I guess, challenges or hurdles that you've encountered designing this versus, say, other designs?
I've never really been a huge fan of the paragraphs of text on a CCG.
Yes.
So if you've ever played Magic the Gathering and your opponent has a chain of cards, you know, and they play like 10 cards that all have a chain effect on them, right? It's not only do you have to know all the unique powers of the cards in your hand, you also somewhat have to know the unique powers of your opponent's card. And in order to really do that properly, you have to read their paragraph of text, sometimes upside down.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Jake and I have created is a language-independent CCG.
Oh, wow.
Where the fortes that give you each card kind of unique boost are not done with a sentence or a paragraph of text with mini icons. They're only done with icons. And we think that's unique. And that means that when we produce this in multiple languages, the only thing that needs to be translated is the rule book. And another thing that we love is the idea that someone from a different country, a different region with a different language, you legitimately could trade with anyone around the world.
That is quite
and
cool.
That card doesn't have to have a translated text.
Yeah. Oh, that's really cool. I'm even more fascinated by this now, because that is quite the challenge. You know, as someone who played Magic a long time ago, and for anyone that still does, you know, dabble in it, there's definitely been a escalation of the scope and the creep of mechanics in that game, and it just gets infinitely more complex when you start to have to look at the interactions with old sets, and it just gets out of control sometimes. So to have something that has language independent and can be understood quite simply with, you know, some interesting interactions is quite the achievement, I think. So that sounds amazing. All right. Well, I think we might finish off our discussion here before we move on to other parts of the podcast with a few questions that we've had from some of our Patreon supporters. And we have covered some of these questions already, so I won't read all of them. But one in particular I wanted to bring up was Shoytan asked this question of you, Mark. He said, given games have on average become much heavier over the last 4 years, do you think Feudum's weight reputation is still valid?
Yeah, that's interesting. My benchmark for a quote-unquote heavy game has always been a game called High Frontier.
Oh, yes. I know that one.
Yeah. Yeah,
that one's rated a 4.8 something, yes, on BoardGameGeek. And if you've ever played that game, which I have, and I actually love it, you actually spend several hours just trying to reach the moon, let alone Saturn or Pluto, you know? And it was invented by a literal rocket scientist.
That's amazing.
And you can tell when you play it. So another heavy one that I think about is a game called Here I Stand.
Oh, yes. I know that one.
Europe in conflict during the Protestant Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
That one's like a 4-something, low fours. So, yeah, seeing Feudum at 4.5 seems off to me.
Mm.
And so, yes, I would say yes. There has to be some sort of readjustment of what's considered a difficult game, I think.
Yeah.
One good thing about Feudum is Ryan from Knights Around a Table just did a How to Play video, which is it's just a glorious video. And I think it's going to introduce Feudum to a lot of people that have otherwise thought it too daunting.
Yeah, I did watch that video. You sent the link. It was very well done. Humor inserted just in the right places, kept you engaged throughout. I'd highly encourage people to actually go and watch that video.
His stuff is great.
Yeah, so good. So to follow, I guess a follow-up question to, you know, do you think Feudum's weight reputation is still valid? It sounds like you're saying it's probably weighted too high than it should be. If you were to put a number to it, what would you put on BGG?
3.9.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay. Because from my personal experience, when I picked up the game secondhand and played it, I was definitely daunted. But to me, the complexity of Feudum sits in the decision space, but each individual action is quite simple to execute. So, yeah.
I think there's also something to be said about creating games that are novel. I think if people don't have the heuristics to kind of look back and go, oh, this reminds me of this mechanic from this game, if you're creating something that's more novel, I think people perceive it as being heavier because they don't have something else to latch onto.
Mm.
And so I wonder if that's also something that's happening with Feudum, because it's quite a unique game mechanically.
Yeah, isn't that amazing, Lauren, how if you play a game that's similar to another game, it's almost as if that other game has prepared you to play the whatever new said game comes out. And I find that to new folks that experience the hobby for the first time, it's like once you get a few euros under your belt, you become a lot better at playing many, many games. And so when a unique game comes out, then yeah, you're right.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mark, for that discussion. That was really insightful, and you definitely have a lot going on. Best of luck to you with all those projects. And I might mention one more thing that we haven't already. We've talked about Feudum a lot. You're going to be doing a 7th anniversary edition on GameFound, I believe it is.
That's right. Yeah, May 14th.
There we go. So if you are curious at all about Feudum and all the wonderful gameplay it has to offer, I encourage you to go check out that game on May 14th on GameFound.
If you're looking for a new board game, you need to check out adventgames.com.au. They have a great range of games, including pre-orders and hot new games. Anything you could be looking for will be there at Advent. Dean provides excellent customer service that is second to none, and he's always keen to support the Australian board game community through events, game days, and even through sponsoring a podcast. So head over to adventgames.com.au today. That's adventgames.com.au.
Right, well, with that, I think we might move on to talking about some games we've been playing, and I might jump in and just talk about some stuff that's been exciting me at this point. So over the past couple of weeks since I was last recording, I got to play a game of Inish, which I haven't played for quite some time, and it didn't disappoint. I love that game so much. Have you played Inish, Mark?
I have not.
Fantastic area control game, very simple mechanics, and a deck of cards, depending on the player count, you may have up to 16 cards that are just turned around, drafted and reset every round, and you use those same 16 cards, and that's all there is to the game. It's absolutely fantastic. I'm amazed at how much game can be shoved into 16 cards sometimes, and Inish is one of those that just absolutely delivers that. Now, another game I got to try that we talked about, I think Dan might have talked about it on the podcast quite some time ago, by some local designers, David and Samara, their game Curses and Covens. I got to try that for the first time. It hasn't come to publication yet, but it will sometime this year from Good Games Publishing. And that is such a fun game. So to give everyone some context about what it is, Curses and Covens is a one versus many game. And you have one player playing as a witch hunter, and the rest of you are playing as villagers that are sympathetic to the witches who do good things for your towns. They heal people and are generally well-beloved in this world that you're playing in. And you have a deck of cards that have witch cards and villager cards, and there's a couple of other spicy, you know, trap cards there as well. And you have a phase where you do a census, and all players, except the witch hunter doesn't have any cards, lay out all their cards. So the witch hunter could see which towns or which players are holding the witch cards. And you discuss openly your strategy about how you're going to hide those cards in during the round. There's a lot of mind games that go on with this. You might say, I'll trade this witch to you over here. And you also have one witch face down on the table, which is the woods that no one else can access. So you can just do a swap for it. And then once you've had your discussion, you pick up your cards again so they're hidden from the witch hunter. And the witch hunter has to then give you an additional card into your hand. So you've now got a new piece of information, but once you've hit this point, you can't discuss strategy anymore. So all of that talking and planning you've done might be thrown out the window because now you've gotten this new card that absolutely changes everything. And I loved that moment when I was playing the game. And so you go around as villagers taking an action each, either to swap, give a card to another village player, or request a card from another village player, or swap with the middle. And once you've done that, the witch then has to blindly pick two cards from the same or different players. And if they hit a witch, they put it out in front of them, and that player will discard the rest of their hand. And the witch hunter will win if they hit five witches. But the players playing the villagers will win if, when they go back to the census phase, are able to reveal three witches of the same suit in one hand. It was just a delight to play. I got to play as the villagers and as the witch hunter, and both times my heart was pounding in my chest because you're trying to put on that poker face and not give anything away. You're trying to double bluff the witch hunter and thinking you might have moved a witch to someone's hand, but maybe you've kept it where it was. It was just brilliant.
My daughter introduced that game to me just recently.
Really?
I just
played it a week or two ago. And we played several rounds, and you're right, it's very addicting.
It's so much fun. I am very, very excited for people to get their hands on this when it comes into full publication. But Curses and Covens was absolutely amazing. Really easy to pick up, great social game, absolutely loved it.
Also just a great theme and setting that I feel like is underused.
Yes.
Astonishingly.
Yep, absolutely, I agree. Lauren, is there anything you've been playing recently that's been hitting the table that you've been loving?
Well, I have replayed a lot of classic Euros that I really love. I actually did also play Caverna recently It's in my top 10 as well. I love it. It's a Euro that manages to be funny somehow with just the weird homesteads that you create. But I've also, true to form, been playing some really weird solo tabletop RPGs. Mm-hmm. There's a few I could highlight. And honestly, sometimes I enjoy just reading about these and their mechanisms, sometimes even more than playing them, just because of how novel and weird and ambitious they can be, these free print and play RPGs. One that I do want to highlight, though, is called Deus Ex Machina. And it's the silliest RPG I think I've played in a long time. It's so basically the headline of it is you are Dave. Who are you? This is a rhetorical question. You are Dave. You're this really aggressively average guy.
Okay.
Who just has such a mundane, dull, boring life. But because of some arcane typo in alternate dimensions, when people are trying to summon a demon, instead they summon Dave. And you're Dave, and you get transported to these weird, bizarre places. But your background is just you're a guy who eats pizza, watches TV, is minding his own business. And when you get transported, the setup for character creation just says, what are your knacks? So you just write three things. They can be hobbies, minor specialties, or party tricks, but they can't be for fighting. And so my Dave, he could break an apple in half with his hands.
Mm-hmm.
He knew all of the words to Rap God by Eminem. And he could make, I think, a water droplet sound by saying,
oh, you're flicking the cheek.
Wit and flicking his cheek. And so he's transported to this kind of Cthulhu nonsense world. And the way the story transpired, he was trying to take down this cult and scared people by speaking in tongues, but really he was just rapping Rap God by Eminem. And I've never encountered a RPG or tabletop RPG that is so kind of, it's so effortless to be creative and weird, because it tells you, you don't have to create a character. You know you're a regular guy. And being a regular guy in a weird setting already makes it really funny. And it kind of pushes you also to be derivative. When it says the setting, it's what's the deal? And it wants you to do X meets Y meets Z. And it says draw on movies, TV shows, books, and mesh these worlds together. So it really goes to great lengths to make it easy for you to create a story, which I find sometimes is the tricky thing with solo RPGing, whether it's journaling or map building or whatever, is you don't have other people to bounce off. But this one for me, it was just really evocative and really fun. It's free, so if you want just a little 45-minute romp that's quite fun, Deus Ex Machina, I highly recommend.
That sounds wild.
Great tip.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Mark, is it, outside of all the work we've been discussing, is there any board games you've played recently that have really surprised you or brought a lot of enjoyment?
Yes. I wouldn't have picked it myself. I went to a game night at a local miniature market, and a fella I had never met before introduced it to me, and so I kind of reluctantly played it. It wasn't really big on the theme. It's about renovating an estate and managing servants and pursuing romance in Victorian England. And I thought, what is this all about? Bridgerton or something? And, you know, my wife watches that, and I'm thinking, do I really want to play this game? Well, it turns out that it's really good. And, you know, it involves hand management and worker placement and deck building. And so you're building your deck of guests you'd like to invite to your lavish parties. And some of them are really good and give you great favors, like the rich Americans, the rich, loud, obnoxious Americans are great, but you get negative points at the end of the game if you still have them in your hand, right?
Yeah.
And so there's a little bit of whimsy there. And it's very, there's a tableau building part of this. And I really loved it. And so I went on Board Game Geek and I looked at, I saw it as 8.2. Rated 8.2 on BGG. And so I bought it. And now my wife and I play it, you know, couple times a week. And she beat me the last time. No, she beat me the last two times. So yeah, I'm in the hole right now. So I'm online reading about, you know, strategy now.
I think we said the name of the game.
It's the name of the game. Obsession,
right? Obsession. It's got to be.
It's Obsession. Yeah. Okay, so you know it. You
yes.
Know it. Yeah, yeah.
That's one I haven't got to try yet, but I remember when it launched, there was a lot of buzz for it what seemed to be a lot of buzz in the Australian board game community for that one. So yeah. Many people absolutely gushing over that one.
It was quite a slow burn though for that game, right? Because it came out in 2018 off the top of my head, quite a number of years ago. And I feel like it just crept up.
And something made it just go bang all of a sudden.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, when you get your hands on it and you pull out not only a rule book, but a substantial rule book, but also this glossary, the designer went to great lengths to build the story and to unveil history. So you can go very, very deep if you like the historical aspect of Victorian England.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah. Nice to see that theme also do well, because I think it's a game that a lot of people didn't want to play because of the theme, or perhaps some people didn't want to play because of the theme, and then was, a pleasant surprise for many, which is really cool.
All right, Lauren, I think you have another game you want to mention for this week's episode.
I do have a few others. I mean, gosh, there's two others. One is a cute little Japanese game called, maybe it's Korean, actually. I should definitely know that. But it's called Sheep and Thief. And for this one, it really is just more than the sum of its parts. It's quite a light game, and I've been able to play it with my nephew. But the cool wrinkle in this game is it has a lot of tropes, like the Carcassonne tile laying, except you're doing that with cards that you've drafted from your hand, and you're connecting rivers and paddocks with sheep that will move around. But when you play something with a thief card, you get to choose how the thief moves, and then that thief is going to move in the same direction on everyone's boards.
Oh.
And so you're trying to get your sheep that you've laid out, because when you play a card that has sheep on it, sheep will populate on it, and you're trying to move those into the towns and into the homes, because then they'll be protected from the thief. But you're also trying to navigate how the thief can move on your board, so to screw up everyone else but not put you in a position that it's going to hoover up your sheep. But the sheep themselves are just kind of little cotton balls. They're not wooden components. They're just these little fluffy balls, which is just such an odd component choice that I think all the kids I've played it with have just really delighted in, which has been really nice. But the drafting, I feel like if you played with adults, could be quite bitey. So I think there is a bit of substance there as well. And the other one I've played, which is just another really silly tabletop RPG that I'm just going to quickly mention. Mm-hmm. It was part of the Solo But Not Alone 4, which I mentioned in a previous podcast, which is still going, but is a bundle of 100 plus solo tabletop RPGs for $10. You get them all, and the proceeds go to mental health related causes once a year, outstanding cause. But that one is called Waffles Exist. And genuinely, it's so silly. But I did it with my partner last night. And the premise is that you're drawing cards from a 52 card deck, and it'll give you a prompt of a kind of combination of two words. And the point of the exercise is just to come up with things that are pleasant in life. So it'll be like spring activity or homely hobby, something like that, right? But this can vary. And the end game trigger for it is when you come up with an idea that is so good that the players agree you have to do that thing right now.
Oh, wow.
And I just thought that was just really charming. It was just really sweet. So the idea of blueberry waffles are great, and this is what it says in the intro, and what day could be bad if you have blueberry waffles? And so we were just talking back and forth to do things, and we came up with something related to baking. We're like, yeah, let's do that right now. That sounds amazing. And so we made banana bread last night. So it just, again, very sweet, very charming. And I just love the way that people are able to be creative with these tabletop RPGs. It kind of never ceases to impress or amaze me.
I have one.
Go for it.
Yes. All right. When I first saw this, I thought it doesn't have the kind of componentry that speaks to me, because I generally like wooden pieces, not plastic. And yet this game not only has a plastic plastic buildings, it has a plastic flat pegboard-like grid into which you place buildings. It's a game called Era, Medieval Age.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And I came upon it and I thought, this is kind of like Tetris in a way. You carefully plan the orientation of your buildings to maximize points. And it's all done on this little, I'm going to say it's like eight inches by 8 inch pegboard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's loads of fun. I can't stop playing it. In fact, I ended up like tracking down where all the, special release buildings were.
Yeah.
And bought them, spent way too much money for them. But now I have all the buildings. And I binge play it with my wife.
That's a fun game. I haven't played that for quite a few years, but yeah, you do a lot of dice rolling behind a screen, and there's a lot of mitigation because there's, I can't remember all the terminology, but essentially some of your buildings can get destroyed throughout the game. Yeah, Era is a fantastic game. Really, really like that one.
I'm sure many listeners are also very familiar with. I liked it, so I spent way too much money buying everything for it. It's going to resonate with a lot of people.
Yes. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, Lauren, do you want to finish off this segment just talking about one other game that I can see you've got listed here on our little run sheet?
Yes. This is a game that I'm surprised hasn't been talked about on the podcast more in depth yet. It's a game that is in my top 50 board games of all time and was designed by a friend of the show, Matthew Dunstan, and that is the Guild of Merchant Explorers. Now, the game did get a bit of flack for having a very generic name, but I really like this game. I really think it is so visually stunning. I quite like it. Maybe that's a hot take, but just really satisfying puzzle. When I first heard of the game, I thought, oh, that should be a flip and write. That doesn't need to be cubes. That doesn't need to be tactile. But playing the game, the wooden components and placing that out on your board adds so much to it. So essentially what you do in this game is you flip over a card that'll have a terrain type, and you're going to place a cube on that terrain type. It'll be one or two or in a row or some sort of placement rule. And everyone's going to do that simultaneously for all the types. But the wrinkle is that you're going to have these powerful cards. So there's going to be four eras of the game, and every era, each person's going to get a unique powerful card that lets them shoot across the board or fill entire types of terrain. And you're just trying to do classical kind of map filling things like connecting routes, getting to the corners of the board, completing various objectives that'll change between games. But it's really these unique powers that make you feel like, ah, I was able to just jet across and get these really satisfying turns. And I think it just does so much to make you feel like you've really accomplished a lot, because you fill your board with cubes. And between the first and the fourth era, in the first era, you'll place a handful, but by the fourth era, you're filling a lot of the board. And not only that, you'll be able to place villages that will remain there, and they will give you different starting points. So initially everyone will have to place their cubes from the center of their map. But as you go and establish villages by connecting these routes or filling up total areas, you can then start from different points on the map. So it does have that roll and write thing where we all started with the same stuff, but look how different our boards ended up, or the different things we were able to do. So yeah, it just is a game that genuinely continues to delight. It is quite solitaire, but I don't mind playing it multiplayer because everyone can kind of just sit and do their own little thing. The tactility adds heaps. There are some expansion maps already out. So the base game, I think, comes with four, but there's an expansion called Queen's Order, I think. I've got it because of course I do. and that adds a few really interesting boards. And Matt has told me that they've got more expansions on the way for this one as well.
Oh, very exciting.
So yeah, if you've not tried it, it's absolutely worth a try, but really just a lovely production, a nice tactile experience, very chill, but lots of just nice satisfying combos and little Euro tropes.
Lauren, I actually tried to play this game 2 Gen Cons ago.
Yeah.
At Indianapolis, and I lined up for a table and everything, but there was no seats left, so I had to walk away.
It was not meant to be.
You've reminded me of it now, so now I'm going to get it.
I think once some of the expansion maps come out as well, they're a bit more ambitious and a bit more kind of rules gritty, and I think have more teeth. So I think the later content will probably be even better than the base content.
Yeah, it's one of those games I just haven't got round to yet. I just I need someone to grab me and sit me down at the table and say we're playing this. So,
and it's snappy. You can play it in like 30 minutes.
Yeah,
it's great.
Very good. So that's the Guild of Merchant Explorers. All right. Well, we've done a lot of talking about board games. I think what we'll do now is we'll move on to our next segment, our question of the pod. But just before I do that, a little bit of announcements so people are up to date with the things that are going on within the community. First of all, we have the Melbourne Game Day, which is on the 9th of March at the Preston City Hall. So we can expect to see Gumnut with a pop-up board game store there for all your purchasing needs. And also Gameway Tables will be there showing off their fantastic wares for some premium gaming experience. But also we'll have the team from Melbourne Executioners back running some D&D one-shots. So if you're into that and want to explore the world of role-playing games a little bit, that's a fantastic chance to give that a go. So we hope that we can see you there on the 9th of March at Preston City Hall. We also have a Brisbane Game Day on the 23rd of March at Royal on the Park. And More Than Meeples will be there with their pop-up store, as well as most of our podcasting crew will be in attendance, if not all of us, I think, at this point, which is a rare opportunity for us as a team of hosts. We rarely get together because we live across the eastern seaboard of Australia, for your reference, Mark, and we'll all be traveling up to the Brisbane area for this game day, which will be a lot of fun. And last but not least, as we'll say many, many times, we're running a convention this year, which is called PlayCon, which will be from the 12th to the 14th of July at Hurstville in Sydney. There'll be all kinds of panels going on with different board game industry people, some trivia, Jackbox, as well as lots of free play, some giveaways, some play to win stuff, and lots of exciting games on display that are new and upcoming from publishers as well. So if you're interested in coming along to that, go to play-con.com, and we hope to see you there as well. All right, so last week's question of the pod was an interesting one. We had a lot of responses, of which we'll read a few off. And the question was, do you have house rules for any of your games? I was not expecting the variety of wide responses that we had for all kinds of different games. Some I disagreed with, some I thought that's actually a really good idea. Off the cuff, Mark, do you have any house rules for any of the games you play regularly?
Well, by the way, I went onto your Discord channel because I was curious about that question. Yes. And the one response I most agreed with was the fellow who said, no house rules. I like to experience the game the way the designer intended.
Yes.
That was music to my ears, because as a designer, you know, you have a way that the game is to be played. However, I have to admit that I do. I do have house rules. Just let's talk about obsession. There's a family, a house in this game. They start with a 4 in reputation, which I thought was too powerful. So I think my house rule is you can't choose that house. But
yeah,
I actually chose that house last time and my wife still beat me. So maybe that's a moot point now. But yes, I guess trying to think of any other house rules. Can't think of any. There's a game I like to play called Adventure Realms, which is kind of I like to think of it as a tribute game to Dune Imperium. It's kind of reskinned to feel more like a 8-bit medieval video game. Anyway, there's a card in there called the White Tree of Hope.
Okay.
And it's way too powerful, in my opinion. And so when my daughter and I play, we remove that card.
Mm. Lauren, do you have any house rules?
Oh, I think only... I said this in the Discord, and I don't know if I'd call it a house rule, but that if we're playing a party game, we basically never score or follow the rules. We kind of just play until it stops being fun and we want to stop. So I think that's the only one I can think of for really light games that have scoring that doesn't need to be there to make them more gamey.
Yeah. Kind of like with telestrations, right? There is a way to score points, but you kind of just draw and have fun laughing at the silliness that unfolded.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's read off a couple of responses. I'll start off with some of our Discord responses that we picked out. Draven said, the rule in our house is usually whoever won the last game is the start player. So they don't go by if you were the last person to touch a flower or whatever it was. It's whoever won last starts the next game. I like it. Simple. I don't think I personally have many house rules, but this one that Jean said, I'm a subscriber to this. So a house rule I have for all solo and co-op games with dice. During a roll, if the dice lands on the floor, you keep the result if it's good or re-roll if it's bad. A legitimate dice roll, it has to be on the table, but if it lands on the floor and it's good, yeah, it would have landed on the table anyway. It's fine. Let's take that and move on. It's a solo game or co-op. The game's probably going to be hard and punishing. It is. Let's make it a tiny bit easier if we have to. And one more from Discord. Jay said, only house rules that jump to mind are family weight stuff to make the games run slightly smoother, like drawing a tile at the end of your turn instead of the start in Carcassonne, or scoring all the trains at the end of the game or scoring all the trains at the end of the game instead of as you go in Ticket to Ride. So just smoothing out the process of scoring as you go or taking a tile at the end of your turn so you can plan a little bit in advance. Yeah, it's not a bad way to smooth things out for maybe kids that need a little bit more time to process things. Lauren, do you want to read a couple of the Facebook responses?
Sure. So we've got Mika who says, I'll often take out cards I think are overpowered or are just not nice, like no ravens in Wingspan and no mandatory quests in Lords of Waterdeep. That's fair, and I think that's something that people do, especially with games that have those really huge decks of cards that it's hard to maybe playtest all the wrinkles out. Jason Craig says, only house rule I use is for Carcassonne. Pick up your next tile at the end of your turn rather than the start. Makes it go so much quicker. Absolutely. Eric Ferger says, we decide starting corporations in Terraforming Mars by bidding. Bidding power is determined by how much starting mega credit from that corporation you sacrifice in order to get the corporation you want.
That's an interesting twist.
Yeah, absolutely. Probably more advanced than for my levels of Terraforming Mars, but that's great. Thomas James says, I was tinkering with Twilight Inscription, and before I knew it, I made a fan-made expansion for the game. It's now the most popular variant. Very cool.
It amazes me how many variants are out there for the world of board games put on BGG. There's so much creativity out there. And, you know, I think I agree with you, Mark. For the most part, you know, I'm very much a person that I will follow the rules. That's the game experience the designer intended me to have. But there's just so many weird and wonderful things that people have come up with, solo modes and team variants and things like that just are quite a delight to explore. There's so many cool things out there that people have tinkered with and made a game more than what it was intended to be.
Yeah, very true. As a designer initially, I tended to be resistant towards that. Mm-hmm. But when Feudum was a game that there's been a lot of, complete expansions that have been invented by people who've approached me saying, what do you think about this? That I've learned to let games that I create become a sandbox for other people to enjoy and create in.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I think for some people, that's a part of the hobby that they love, is taking some game that inspires them and tweaking it and exploring the design space in there, for sure.
Absolutely. That's awesome. And one more, we've got Suzanne Wood, who says, we take out components if they add a minor unnecessary aggression element to the game.
That's one I disagree with. I want that player interaction. I love those fighty games. So, but yeah, to each their own.
Totally. I get that, though. I think if the take that is easier to subtract and it's not your cup of tea, then...
Here's one that's similar. No table talk. Because sometimes you, by pointing out something that an opponent doesn't see, can actually help you win, because it damages the third player.
Mm.
And so we say no table talk so that everyone is responsible for his or her own play.
Mm. Yep. That's an interesting one. There are definitely some games I enjoy. I'd assume that rule is not then applying to games that are very much incentivizing that negotiation sort of talk. No, that's absolutely fair. All right, a couple more responses. I'll read one from Twitter. Ben Pinchback said, in Catan, the first time round the table, we reroll sevens. So there's none of that stealing and halving one. Fair enough. I played Catan a lot growing up. I don't recall that being a problem, but maybe it is. And a couple more I'll read from our Instagram audience. We've got Lala Games that said, Uno, the +4 draw and the +2 draw can be stacked. We're brutal in my household. And one more, Undiscovered Games said, in Carcassonne, we never use farmers. I wish we did, but I always get outvoted. Our group prefers no farmers. Crazy, I know.
That's how you win in Carcassonne, farmers.
There's big points in the farmers for sure. Fantastic. Well, thank you to everyone that responded to last week's question of the pod. If you want to participate in this segment, you'll find the question posted in our Discord channel, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as well. And we look forward to seeing those responses. So for a new question of the pod, since we've had Mark on the show and we've talked about his designs and what's upcoming as well, for me, I wanted to pose this question. Being my experience with Feudum and some of the really interesting design that he's described in Four Lords, I'll pose this question. What is the most unique gaming experience you've had? Now, that could be unique in terms of a setting you were in, or that could be unique in terms of the mechanics and the gameplay, whatever you want to describe as being a unique game experience. So for me, I'll start us off just answering this question simply. The most recent experience comes to mind, and one that we've talked about in recent episodes, would be playing the RPG game Alice is Missing. So if you haven't heard about that one, Alice is Missing is a role-playing game that's played over text. So it's just text message, it's timed, and I had never experienced anything else like that. And I really had a good experience. And the music soundtrack that we played to was evocative and thematic. I really, really loved playing that. So for me, that was one of the most unique gaming experiences I've had. Mark, do you have anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, especially along the lines of mechanics.
Mm.
Mechanics are central to my gaming enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
When I think about games where I've played them and I'm like, wow, I've never experienced this mechanic before, I think of Traitors of Genoa. It's an oldie but a goodie, but it has a stack of tiles that you grab and you move from one space to the next, leaving a trail. The bottom one stays in place as you go. I'd never seen that before.
Mm.
Another game that comes to mind is Shogun by Dirk Hahn. It has this super cool cube tower, and you throw a bunch of cubes into it, and hopefully certain cubes come out the bottom because that tells you who wins the battle. And it's a luck element, but you can drop cubes into the tower to kind of make your own luck for future cube drops. Yeah, those two come to mind.
Yeah. You've reminded me now of one board game that I feel like had a very unique mechanic. That's Mysthia. I don't know if you've ever heard of that one. Tabula Games was the publisher. And in that one, it's an area control game, and the board is set up to have these spheres, which you can jump from sphere to sphere. And it's like they're floating islands. And there's a mechanic in the game where you can push one of them into the center and then it repositions all of the other spheres around it. I've never played an area control game where the literal areas change and evolve and move over the course of the game. That was such a fun experience. I really need to table that again. It's a longer game. It was sort of that 3-hour mark, but I thoroughly enjoyed that one. Just that dynamic board was something really, really cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think some of the most unique experiences I've had have been with some of the LCG scenarios I've played, just how much they can do with cards and so few components. And I talk about it to death, but Arkham Horror, the card game, some of those scenarios, just the ingenuity and the creativity with how evocative just cards can be on a table, it has always been outstanding. And really sticks out to my mind when I think of what's really unique.
Fantastic. All right. Well, our question for this week, as I've said, is what's the most unique gaming experience you've had? So by all means, when we post out the question, please share your responses and we'll read some of those next week. All right. Before we move on to the last segment, I just need to give a community shout out and thank you to our Patreon supporters. Cannot express enough appreciation for all that you do in supporting this show, and a special shout out this week to Chris Snowden, Colin McCarthy, and Darren Jordan. Thank you all so much for supporting this show. And if you want to support the show in other ways, you can go to Facebook and become a member, start answering the questions that we put out, become a part of the Discord community, leave an Apple Podcast rating or even Spotify star rating. Just get involved, come to the game days. We love to interact and talk with everyone about board games and have a lot of fun together. So thank you. And of course, thank you for listening to the show. That's another great way to support us as well. And with that, I think we'll move on to our final segment, which is Swear and Oath. All right, so for our final segment, I might kick us off and report back on what I swore last time, which was to continue playing the campaign of Mythwind. I haven't managed to continue playing yet, as I didn't want to take that away from... Okay, let's step back a little bit and give more context. I might have said this last time. It's a game I've played with my partner. She's not into board games as much as I am. And it was a game that I thought she would enjoy, and we played, and she has since asked to play it again. We just haven't found the time to. I could have stepped away and kept playing it solo, but I don't want to do that. So it's very much on my radar to still do, to continue that campaign of Mythwind. But to add a new challenge to what I want to do in the future, this week there was some news that got me all excited that I haven't felt in quite some time, and that was that Chip Theory Game put out an announcement that they were going to launch at some point soon their final content for Cloudspire. I love this game to bits, and so that got me all excited, and I've decided I need to finish all of the solo campaigns. I have all the expansions. I've just got one more factions solo experience and solo campaign to do. I want to get that done. So I am going to swear to finish the Cloudspire solo campaign content that I have left in anticipation hotly for whatever else they release for that final bit of the game.
That's awesome. Mark, did you have the context for the swear and oath portion of the podcast?
Yes, I think I get the idea. I guess I'm ready to swear an oath.
All right. By all means.
You want to go first, Lauren? Does she get to do it, or do I?
I can jump in first. So my last oath was just to chip away at my 10x10 challenge for the year, which I was able to do. played Guild of Mansion Explorers, played Caverna, and a few others. So was able to do that, which was good. And my new oath is going to be to play a game that I've wanted to play for a very long time. And I was reminded of it in talking about the theme of fur, which is a game called Lignum, which is a Euro game that I've wanted to try for a while, about logging in the 19th century, that has a rondel mechanism and is meant to just be really tight and quite bitey. And so, yeah, definitely want to give that a try. So that's my new oath, is to give Lignum a try.
Fantastic. All right, Mark, what are you going to swear to do?
All right, well, there's a backstory behind this oath I'm about to swear. Let's hear it. So a lot of my game ideas come from things I read about, and I've been reading about the Iditarod, the 1,000-mile sled race across Canada. And for a while, I thought, you know, maybe I could develop a game about that. But man, these poor dogs, they run them into the ground. It's controversial.
Mm.
I think I can't make a game about this. Mm. But I have these mechanics that I've written down already. You know, what do I do with these mechanics? And they've just been sitting there. And so I live on a lake, and I've been reading about migrating geese, Canada geese, mm-hmm. actually. And I see them mm-hmm. in my backyard. And they're camped out there right in front of me for several days when the water was frozen. And so it just clicked. Hey, I can reskin some of these mechanics, and I can make a game about migrating geese.
Very cool.
Cool.
So I swear to spend more time developing a game about geese. How's that?
Fantastic. Amazing. I love it. Well, next time we have you on the podcast, I'm hoping you'd love to come back at some point in the future. We can grill you on the progress of that one.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Fantastic. Well, that brings us to the end of our show for this week. Big thank you to Mark Swanson. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Really appreciated having that chat. It was very insightful.
It's been a pleasure to have you, really. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Lauren. Thank you, Jules.
No problem. And Mark, if people want to follow the progress of all the projects you've been working on, what's the best place for people to reach you?
You can go to oddbirdgames.com, or you can follow me on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter or X, as it is now called.
Fantastic. Thank you again, and thank you everyone to listening. Bye for now. We'll see you next week.
See ya.